The book of Exodus is one of those that the title kind of really helps you remember a lot about what the book is about, in that it is God's plan to bring about the exodus of the people from the land of Egypt, from bondage. And really, that's only a portion of the book of Exodus. It really begins a new chapter for the children of Israel in terms of their relationship with God and so forth. And we always want to keep in mind, anytime we're studying Old Testament Scripture, that it is valuable for us in that it allows us to see the nature of God, to understand Him better, so that as we serve Him today under the New Testament law, we have a better understanding of what He expects of us through learning about His dealings with man in the Old Testament. And I kind of want to take just 5 or 6 minutes here and kind of go through some of the chapter content in Exodus before we actually get into our lesson this evening. In chapter 1, the children of Israel are in Egypt. They've been there for approximately 400 years. And in verse 8, there's a key statement. It says, "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph." Of course, we know the story of how the children of Israel got to Egypt and how God used Joseph to provide protection for His people as was needed because of the famine. And so in chapter 1, we see that they've been in Egypt for a long time. There's been a succession of pharaohs, and it comes to a point where a pharaoh arises that did not know Joseph, who was not familiar with the position that he had in Egypt, did not have the care and concern for Joseph's brethren that previous pharaohs had had. And so because of that, they enslaved the Egyptians. In chapter 2, we learn about Moses, and really it covers a pretty good section of Moses' life just in chapter 2. We see that he is born, and the Egyptians are concerned about the children of Israel getting too many in number, and so they're trying to reduce the number of Israelites that there are, and lest that they join with their enemies and rise up against them. And so that's kind of the scene that's going on in chapter 2 when Moses is born and his mother hides him, and he is found by Pharaoh's daughter. And then in the latter part of chapter 2, he becomes very high up in Egypt. He ends up killing an Egyptian, and because of that, it becomes common knowledge that he's done this, and so he decides to flee. Now, how old was Moses when he fled Egypt after killing the Egyptian? Anybody remember? All right, he was 40. And it's kind of easy to remember those divisions of Moses' life, and we'll talk about that a little bit more as we get a little further in the chapter content. Of course, chapter 3, he is in the wilderness. He has come into contact with Jethro and has taken one of his daughters as a wife. Probably the most significant event that happens in chapter 3 is that God appears to him in the burning bush. And, of course, we know about the excuses that Moses makes so forth when God basically tells him that he's going to use him to deliver the people. Then in chapter 4, Aaron is made his spokesman. He becomes sort of the mouthpiece for Moses. Remember that one of Moses' objections was that he was not an eloquent man. He was slow of tongue, was not able to speak well, and so Aaron is kind of made his spokesman. And who is Aaron to Moses? His brother. Chapter 5, they begin their discussions with Pharaoh. And he tells Pharaoh to, you know, thus says the Lord of God, you shall let my people go, or tells him to let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the early part of chapter 5. And what is Pharaoh's response? Who is God that I should obey His voice? Of course, the Pharaohs in Egypt were practically considered gods and by the people and as well as themselves. That kind of comes into play as we talked about several times on several classes about the phrase that God hardened his heart. It wasn't that God did something to Pharaoh to cause his heart to harden. It was because it was Pharaoh's attitude, and I think a lot of this attitude of his own, the Pharaohs had an attitude of their own preeminence, and because of that, it led them to think of themselves as God, and harden his heart when he was told to let the people go, even after, you know, several of the plagues. Chapter 6 is the story about Aaron's rod. And chapter 7, the water is turned to blood, and so the plagues begin. Chapter 8 was frogs, lice, and flies. Chapter 9 was the murrain of cattle, boils, hail. Chapter 10, Moses and Aaron have a little bit longer discussion with Pharaoh. It seems that by this point, a lot of the plagues are not affecting the Egyptians. I mean, the Israelites are only affecting the Egyptians. And it seems as though Pharaoh is kind of getting a little bit better picture of God and His power and so forth. And they have a little bit longer discussion with Him, but he continues to harden his heart. There's the plague of locusts and the thick darkness. And then in chapter 12 are the instructions for the Passover. Of course, the Passover was the event that coincided with the death of the firstborn, which was the final plague, the final straw that caused Moses to, I mean, caused Pharaoh to let the people go. And they were given the instructions with regard to the Passover, and then that feast was instituted. And in the latter part of chapter 12, he basically releases the people. They are traveling out in the wilderness. Pharaoh changes his mind and pursues them in chapter 14, and the Red Sea is divided. They escape. Chapter 15 is predominantly the Song of Moses, as they celebrate the victory that God has given them over the Egyptians by leading them through the Red Sea and then watching their enemies die as the Red Sea closed in on them. And then in chapter 16, well, really the latter part of chapter 15, let me find the verse I'm looking for. with regard to them complaining about needing water. Verse 22, so Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea. Then he went into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. So the people began to murmur because of that. And they are led to water, but there's a problem with the water in that it's bitter. It's undrinkable. And so Moses goes to God, and God tells him to take the limb of a tree that he would show him and put it in there, and the waters would be made sweet. And of course, the word Mara means bitter. Chapter 16, we studied last week where God provides the manna and also the quail. And then that kind of takes us up to where we are tonight. Anything anybody wants to add to that? Just a kind of a real quick review of what we've covered so far this quarter. So in chapter 17, the children of Israel are leaving the wilderness of Sin, and they go to, they're heading towards a place called Rephidim. And again, they have a problem in that they want water. And they complain about this to Moses, and Moses' response is to them in verse 2 is, "Why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord?" And basically they reiterate the idea that they had stated before, that he's brought them out here to die in the wilderness. And so Moses goes to God and said, "You know, what am I going to do with these people? They're ready to stone me because they want water." And so God gives Moses instructions. He's to take some elders of the children of Israel and go to a rock that God would show him in Horeb, and he's to take his rod with him, and he is to smote the rock, and water would come forth from the rock, and he, of course, did that, and water was provided for the children of Israel. And he named the place Massah and Meribah. And Massah means contention, and Meribah means to test or testing, because the people contended with Moses over, you know, having water, and tested the Lord, despite the fact that they had seen what God had done before in terms of providing water. Now, this was a little bit different situation in that Moses actually struck a rock, and water came forth from the rock, where before it, at Mara, they found water, but it just wasn't fit to drink. And so God made it sweet by giving Moses the instructions that he did. So it's a little bit different situation. Nevertheless, the people lacked in faith. And I think that there's probably a lesson there for us. I know that in my own life, there are times when I've gone through periods where I struggle with my faith, and you know, I might have even felt like, you know, nothing's going my way. You know, where is God to help me? That kind of thing. And I think all of us kind of face those times in our lives. And it's stories like this where we see the children of Israel. And we'll see it again many times before they get to the point where they're ready to invade and conquer the land that God promised them, that their faith was waning, and God kind of brings them along like a parent would bring a child along and shows them and teaches them and helps them to try to come to an understanding of what kind of faith they need to have in God. And so I think we can all learn a lesson from that, is that we, if we continue to have faith in God, He is going to allow us to be tested. But if we have faith in Him and trust in Him, that He will be with us and He will see us through those hard times. And that will help us to grow in faith. Any other comments about that particular story? Y'all feel free to speak up now. I, like Moses, am not eloquent, so I need all the help I can get. The next thing that we see happen is, and Bernie kind of mentioned this Sunday morning, there were these bands of raiders from the Amalekites. And they would come in and kind of conduct these raids on the outskirts of the area where the children of Israel were. I suspect that they conducted raids on nomads and other people that might be, you know, in the vicinity. But they were not a good people. And of course God recognizes that, and He's going to make some promises with reference to that. And when you kind of think about the children of Israel, this is a very, very large group of people, you know, traveling through the wilderness, and they would have their, you know, their camps set up in various areas and cover a pretty wide area. So, you know, there might be a group over here that might be, you know, a little distance from another group because they had flocks and things of that nature. Needed to graze and need to have an area to keep them and so forth. So it's not like they were all bunched up together and, you know, around one little campfire. It was you know, pretty spread out. And so the Amalekites would take advantage of that and kind of attack those, particularly if they perceived that they were weaker. And so God tells, or God through Moses, basically calls Joshua and tells him in verse 9 to choose us some men and go out and fight with Amalek. And tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. And so Joshua did as Moses said. Of course, this is really the first time that we're introduced to Joshua. And Joshua's going to become a very prominent figure, as we know, over the period of the wandering in the wilderness and an invasion and conquest of the land. And so basically he tells them to take these men and they're going out to do battle with Amalek to basically stop this raiding and so forth that's going on. And so the next day, Joshua takes the men out. Moses is up on a high place or a rock or whatever looking over them. And as long as he holds that rod up, the children of Israel prevail. Well, if you've ever held your arms up over your head for any length of time, it doesn't take long for them to get heavy, especially if you've got a rod in your hand. And so we get tired and his arms would come down, and then the Amalekites would prevail. And he had two people with him, Aaron and Hur. And, of course, they saw what was going on, and it appears from the text, too, that even those that were in battle were, you know, aware of this. And so they set Moses down on a rock, and one of them got on each side of him, and they held his arms up. And they did this until it was dark. And Israel was able to defeat Amalek. And that's in verse 13. And in verse 14, then the Lord said to Moses, write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under the heaven. And Moses built an altar and called its name, the Lord is my banner. For he said, because the Lord has sworn, and the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. And we see through the history of the Old Testament that there were a number of run-ins with the Amalekites. God even used the Amalekites to punish the children of Israel at one point. But eventually, they would be wiped out and destroyed. There were occasions where God told them that their iniquity was not yet full. God wasn't through with Amalek yet. But eventually he did fulfill that promise. And I think that was in Samuel. Let's see. 1 Samuel 15, where we see that prophecy eventually fulfilled. So again, God is there. He's fighting for the Israelites. The children of Israel see this. In particular, these men that went out in battle against the Amalekites. They recognized through this memorial that Moses was to write and recount in the hearing of Joshua. And I don't think he meant in the hearing of Joshua alone, but in all of those men that Joshua was leading to make the point to them that they were given this victory by God, that God was with them and protected them. And so we see how God is continuing to look after them and to take care of them, even though they are weak in faith and murmuring and things of that nature. God continued to care for them and watch out for them. Any questions about anything there in chapter 17 or comments? All right. Chapter 18, someone that we've met before shows up, and that is Jethro. And who was Jethro? All right, he was Moses' father-in-law. And he brought somebody with him when he came to Moses. And who was that? All right. Brought his wife and his two sons, Zipporah and Gershom, and the other name leaves me. Eliezer, yeah. And just an interesting side note that Gershom means foreigner because he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land, and Eliezer was named Eliezer, which means God of my help, because God had come to his aid. And so because of that, Moses named the two boys that. So they come, and Jethro goes in with Moses, and Moses tells him about all the things that God has done for them. And a lot of that we just recounted when we went through the chapter content of how God's providence was with Moses and protected him, put him in a position to lead the people out, and gave him victory over Pharaoh. He was able to take the people out of their bondage and of course lead them across the Red Sea. And Moses recounts this to Jethro. Now, do you think Jethro might have already heard about this? Imagine it was probably somewhat well known. And we kind of talked about that in can't remember if it was Sunday morning or last Wednesday was singing, so I guess it was Sunday morning that we talked about the fact that these great events that happened were began to be known. And I'm sure Jethro had heard some stories about some of the things that God had done for the children of Israel. But now he's getting a first-hand account from Moses. And Jethro recognizes and makes the statement that God is more powerful and above all the gods and so forth. And he offers sacrifice to God. And I want to read a little excerpt from Bob's book here that I thought was interesting. This is, if you've got the book, it's on the bottom of page 40, at least of the edition that I've got. Jethro rejoiced at all the good things Jehovah had done and said, "Blessed be Jehovah because of all the wonderful things he has done for Israel in delivering them from Egypt. Now I know that Jehovah is greater than all gods." It was proven when they dealt proudly against him. Jethro offered burnt offerings and other sacrifices. Thus Jethro was recognized by Moses and Aaron and the elders as a true priest of God, just as Melchizedek and had been in the days of Abraham. Now, remember that up to this point, the law had not been given, the formal law, requirements of the priest, the tabernacle and all that. We're going to see that, happen. But at this point, that hasn't happened. And so it was a little different situation than it was once the Levites were set up as the tribe that the priests were to come from and so forth, in a more formal way through the law of Moses. And then, the next day, Jethro observes Moses and as he leads the people, and all of the people of Israel, and as we already mentioned, this was a great, great throng of people. They come to Moses and bring their problems, if they've got a problem between one another, and Moses judges them, tells them what to do, reveals God's will in the particular matter that's being brought to him. And Moses did this from daylight to dark, pretty much all day long. And Jethro observes this and he says, "What in the world are you doing? If you continue to do this, it's going to wear you out and frustrate the people. Because you're just not going to be able to render this service to this many people for any length of time." And so he makes a suggestion to Moses that he sets up these trusted men, these men who were wise, and that the people were to come to these men, and they would take care of whatever problems that they could take care of, the smaller matters and so forth. And then if it was a bigger matter or something that these men could not handle, then it would be taken to Moses. And that way the people could have their problems resolved, and it wouldn't wear Moses completely out and frustrate the people. And so Moses does that, and he sets up these men, and kind of sets up this arrangement so that the people's issues can be heard and judged upon. It reminds me of our appeals situation where we may go to a a lesser court and we don't like the judgment there, we can appeal to a higher court, and so forth. Seemingly endless sometimes, but anyway, it's kind of the same type thing. And so the next day, in verse 13, I'm sorry. Verse 25, Moses chose able men out of Israel and made them heads over the people, rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties and tens, and they judged the people. And that kind of takes us through the end of chapter 18. Any questions or comments about that? Right. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I had had a mark here to kind of mention that it was, you know, it wasn't that Jethro, you know, said you ought to do this and Moses went right ahead and did it. Jethro encouraged him to do it, but he also encouraged him to make sure that that's what God wanted him to do. And evidently Moses did that, and so. The system was set up so that the people's voices could be heard. All right, the children of Israel are, as we said, at Rephidim. And they're about to move and head to the wilderness of Sinai, where they actually come to the mountain of Sinai. And just in kind of in way of review, if you've got the book on page 41, there is a route of the Exodus. And, of course, they started off in Ramesses in Egypt. They went to Succoth, Etham, and then they came upon the Red Sea and... You know, the people murmured, they crossed on dry land, the Egyptian army was destroyed there. Then they came to Marah, where the people again murmured, and they found the bitter water, and God gave Moses the instructions. And then they came to Elim, where the 12 springs of water were. And then they moved to the wilderness of Sin, which is where they began to murmur about, you know, food and that kind of thing. And the quail came in the evening and the manna began. And, of course, they were given the instructions about how to deal with the manna. They were only to gather so much. And on the sixth day, they were to gather twice as much. So they did not gather any on the seventh day or on the Sabbath. And so that God set that Sabbath test before them. And then they came to Rephidim, which is where they've been as in our study tonight, where they murmured, and again, water was provided for them, this time from a rock. They had the battle of the Amalekites and Jethro's visits. And then now they're going to move on to Mount Sinai. And at Mount Sinai, they're going to stay for a little while. A lot of the next several chapters deal with things that happened at Sinai. When they get to Sinai, how long has it been since they left Egypt? Anybody remember? It was in the third month. In fact, verse 1 of chapter 19, in the third month after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the same day, they came to the wilderness of Sinai. So it appears like it was 3 months to the day It's the same day of the month, 3 months later. Of course, we've recounted the various places or stops that they made along that journey as they left Ramesses, and now they've come to the to Mount Sinai and to the wilderness of Sinai around the mountain. And in verse 3 of chapter 19, and Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. God is reminding them of some of the things that we've already talked about this evening, how he's taken care of them. He's brought them out from under the bondage of the Egyptians and borne them on the eagle's wings, it says in verse 4. And now he's brought them to this mountain, and this mountain is where Moses is going to go up, and he's going to receive the commandments of the Lord and so forth. And so they're being reminded of that God has been with them. And he says in verse 5, now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the children of Israel. And so God tells Moses this and tells him what he's supposed to relay to the people. Again, it does good to go back here and remember the promises that God made to the people. And there were three of those promises, and what were they? Land, seed, and nation. All right, land, seed, and nation. And really, the one that they're not ready for the land yet. And of course, the seed will come later. But he's making of them right now a great nation. They've been blessed in Egypt. They grew to a large number, even to the point where the Egyptians were afraid of them and tried to control their population. And so God has brought them to become a nation. And he tells Moses to tell them that that they're going to be a special people to him, a special treasure, uses the term treasure in the New King James. Right. Exactly. Right. And so the children must, the children of Israel must be obedient to him, and that he will take care of them. And of course in that, he reiterates the idea that he's taken care of them already to this point. And now he's, just as a father might talk to a young child and say, you're getting older, I expect you to start behaving and be the kind of person that I've taught you to be. And it's kind of that same idea. God is bringing the people along, the children of Israel along, a lot like an earthly father would bring his children along and teach them. And as they become more mature, they're able to handle more. And so Moses basically in verse 7 relays this information he calls for the elders of the people. And laid these words before them, told them what God had said, and all the people answered and said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do. So Moses brought back the words of the people to the Lord. So You know, they're here at Sinai. God's taking care of them. They're not really in a situation where they're murmuring right now. Okay. And so they say, "Yes, Lord, we're going to do what you said to do." All right, we're out of time. We'll pick up there. About verse 9 on Sunday morning. Thank you for your comments and participation.